Lecture 10, Inequality and Insecurity in the 1990s.
The United States economy has accomplished something extraordinary during the 20th century. It started the century in first place as the global leader in standard of living measured by per capita GDP, and it's ending the century as leader as well. By our basic rough measure, per capita GDP, that is, take the size of the economy, divide it by the population, we're more than five times as well off as our great-grandparents back in 1900. Heck, we're more than twice as well off as the average American was in 1960. The story of food consumption during the century tells much of it. If you compare a typical diet in the 1990s to one at the start of the century, based on U.S. Department of Agriculture calculations, the diet has about the same amount of calories and of protein. However, our modern diet has about one-third more fat, as well as large increases in many vitamins. It also has a great decrease in bulk. The average person now eats about 350 pounds less of food each year than they did at the turn of the century. Most of the decrease is that we eat a lot less flour, a lot less potatoes, a lot less bread. We also eat less red meat than we ate at the start of the century and have increased consumption of sugars and poultry. Of course, there's also a vast increase in the variety of foods available. Older folks may remember when a banana or an orange was considered an exotic fruit. Now in the 1990s, small children in Minnesota eat kiwi and no one thinks anything about it. Almost every household in the 1990s has appliances that would have seemed magical at the turn of the century. A refrigerator, radio, TV. About two-thirds of households have washing machines, microwaves, air conditioning. Half have a dishwasher. Throw in things like cars, video cassette players, home computers, greater space in our homes, the variety of clothing and different materials, the ability to travel, high levels of education, medical advances. Our standard of living would be literally unimaginable to people of 1900. And maybe even unimaginable to those of 1925 or 1950. This higher standard of living is true even though we went through world wars and smaller wars, through many recessions and a Great Depression, through radical restructuring of major sectors of the economy, like agriculture and then manufacturing, through a blizzard of different government programs, ranging from wage and price controls to more subtle regulation. This higher standard of living is true even though the population has increased dramatically by a factor of almost four. True even though the work week is shorter. True even though a greater concern for avoiding racial and gender bias has come about. We've expanded individual freedom. It's true even though we have new regulations to remedy many kinds of unfairness or lack of safety or environmental problems. Some people will say in the 1990s that they think, you know, the innovations are pretty much done, that we've done what there is to do. When people say that, it seems to me that it's just a failure of imagination. I mean, people had the same failure of imagination in the 1920s and the 1950s. I mean, I don't know what's going to come next in the 21st century either, but at least I'm smart enough to know that history proves that my failure of imagination doesn't prove that there won't be massive changes which we can't even really think about today. With this astonishing record of growth, it is intriguing to me that the 1990s have been such a time of people feeling insecure about the jobs and the economy. After all, after this century of growth, why should it be so that people feel this level of insecurity? Well, I think it begins in the early part of the 1990s with the recession that started off the century. Again, this is a story which involves oil producers, it involves inflation, and it involves the Federal Reserve. This time, the story is that Iraq invades Kuwait, and President Bush responds by forging an international force with the approval of the United Nations to roll back that aggression. The war is not a major one, but there are fears of oil shortages and prices do go up for a time. There's a threat of inflation, and the Federal Reserve pushes up interest rates to avoid that inflation and tips the economy into a recession. Now, the recession itself is shallow. In the context of large economic events of the century, it's really not worth much comment. But it does mean that because of the timing of the recession, there is essentially zero creation of new jobs during George Bush's presidency. And I think that starts off the 1990s as a decade of anxiety in the workplace and anxiety about jobs. And it, of course, leads to Bill Clinton being elected president in 1992. A second factor then creating discomfort among workers begins with the Clinton merger boom, which follows up on the merger booms of the 1980s. There's a certain political irony here. Since Clinton and the Democrats, you know, ran against those merger booms of 1980s, that was the decade of greed. That was when things were bad. And then, of course, when Clinton took office, there's a whole new merger boom, which in fact is even larger than the merger boom was back in the 1980s. The merger boom of the mid-80s peaked in 1989 with $316 billion in deals. It declined by about two-thirds during Bush's presidency, and that's a recessionary time. There's not a lot of buying and selling of companies going on. But 1995 saw an all-time high of $356 billion worth of mergers and acquisitions. Now, the Clinton merger boom really was focused in a few different industries. About half of the mergers that happened were in telecommunications, healthcare, financial services, and defense industries. And of course, these are all industries which are going through major shakeups at the time. For example, spending cutbacks led to a need for the defense industry downsizing and mergers. Cost containment pressures led to the healthcare mergers. And a combination of new laws and technical opportunities are reshaping the telecommunications and financial services industries. Are these good or bad? Well, if you're, you know, really what you have to do again is wait about a decade to see how all these kinds of deals work themselves out. To workers caught in the web of what's going on, these deals certainly seem unpleasant, sort of like stock market speculators are playing God with your life. But as we discussed in the 1980s, mergers are also a way in which the market can exert some discipline on companies. Companies can go on and on and on and on without necessarily performing very well, and there has to be some mechanism in the market for booting out their management and bringing in new people. Mergers are that kind of a way of cleaning house and bringing in new folks. It's always worth remembering that the alternative to stock market discipline is not that everyone is happy, no jobs ever disappear, and you know wages just go up forever. The alternative is that there's a lack of discipline in the market. There's a lack of efficiency. And managers who already don't have a lot of constraints on them might be even more free to award themselves big bonuses. Third change in the 1990s that affects the labor market is the growth in inequality that happens. And in fact, this is not really something that starts in the 1990s. You can trace the growth of inequality back a certain way. You remember when we were last talking about inequality, it was the Great Compression of the 1940s, where we had a lot more equality after that decade. The level of inequality stays much the same through the 50s and 60s, and then sometime, it's a little bit hard to date, in the 1970s or the 1980s, we begin to see greater inequality. By the 1990s, inequality is back at about the same level it was in 1940, before the Great Compression started. One way of thinking about this is to think about it in terms of quintiles. A quintile just means divide up the income distribution into five groups. In the 1980s, if you think about the total income received by the top fifth of the income distribution, it was about 44.1%. By 1990, it's up to about 46.6%. So the top fifth is getting a larger share than they were getting before. Now, most of that increase is actually accounted for by the top 5% of all households. The share of the top 5%, they had 16.5% of all the income in 1980, and they're up to 18.6% of all the income by 1990. So there's clearly a greater move toward the rich having a greater share of the income. Now, when this happened during the 1980s with a conservative Republican president in office, Ronald Reagan, it was easy to assume that it must be Reagan's fault, that somehow his conservative policies were causing this. But frankly, hardly anyone who's an economist believes this is true. Let me try and describe some of the reasons. First of all, you can see some of this starting to happen in the 1970s, depending on which data you look at, and it's hard to blame Ronald Reagan for the 1970s, whatever you think of his policies later. Second of all, it happens internationally, and it's hard to blame Ronald Reagan for the changing income distribution in Germany or in Mexico or something like that. Third of all, the inequality that happened affected pre-tax income. It affected wages that people were being paid, and it's their wages that became more unequal. So it wasn't a case of people being able to keep a larger share of their money or of tax cuts or welfare payments. We're talking about what the market was generating became more unequal. And finally, this inequality continued to expand after Reagan left office. Indeed, it's continuing right through Bill Clinton's presidency. Now, if you're going to blame Reagan for the inequality of the 1980s, you got to be willing to blame the Democrats and Bill Clinton for continuing it through the 1990s. The truth is, it probably was not a presidential policy which caused this. Among those who've really studied the subject, it's just not true that Reagan's economic policies are part of the inequality that's happened. What was the cause? The typical reason given is that the demand for low-skilled labor has gone down, and low-wage labor is getting paid less than it was in the 1970s. On the other hand, the demand for high-skilled labor has been going up and up. And the primary reason for that, just as it was back in the 1920s, is the new technologies which are available in the economy. In the 1990s and 1980s, we mean the new computer and information technologies. Those who work with those technologies, if you have the power and the education to do so, have the ability to expand what they can do. They can be more productive and do more work than they could before. And those who are incapable of using those technologies or don't have the background or the access to them are going to be paid less and less. That's also a good explanation because it explains why this would be happening all over the world at the same time. This is something that's impacting many developed countries all at once. It's also, of course, the factor which is causing a lot of the downsizing and mergers as companies reorganize themselves to take advantage of these new systems. What are some of the other explanations people toss out? And why aren't those such good explanations? Some people say, for example, that the inequality is because of trade with third world countries, that our low-wage workers are having to compete with workers in China and Mexico. Well, such trade has increased over time, but it's still only maybe 2 or 3% of our gross domestic product. And it's hard to believe that trade which affects only 2 or 3% of our gross domestic product is changing our whole income distribution that sharply and benefiting the top 5% in some weird way. You can explain why lower wage folks might be hurt to some extent by this, but it clearly can't be the whole story. Other people in the 1990s have focused on a story about immigration and said that the greater immigration that followed the 1965 Immigration Act has led to more competition for low-wage jobs. And there's no question that there has been an upsurge of immigration in recent decades, although there are various different ways of playing with the numbers to make it look bigger or smaller. Now, there are several different concerns about immigration. Let me try and sort them out. One set of concerns is whether or not people are culturally coming from places that are like our current American culture. I don't feel like that's economics. I'm going to ignore that argument. A second set of arguments have to do with whether or not immigrants cause more unemployment. Now, that's not likely to be a worry. Think about all the workers the U.S. economy has absorbed over this century, as its population has grown vastly, as women have entered the workforce and so on. Unemployment clearly is something that we can overcome. We can take in vast new numbers of workers, far higher than any level of immigration. The real question about unemployment is questions about whether we're in a recession and whether we have enough aggregate demand and things like that. But clearly our economy is capable of absorbing vast number of workers and giving them jobs. A third set of concerns are about whether immigrants are a burden on government. For example, in terms of expenses for schooling their kids, welfare payments, medical care, and all those kinds of things. And people contrast that with what immigrants pay into the system in terms of taxes withheld, Social Security payments, and so on. As an economic argument, this is just a horrible mess. But in trying to summarize a large body of argument here, I would make a couple of different points. There are certainly parts of the country, like Southern California, which are hit very, very heavily by immigrants. And so for those areas, it's probably true that the costs they're paying may be greater than the benefits they're getting in those limited areas. If you look overall at the country as a whole, it's probably true that the benefits of immigration are somewhat greater than the costs. However, the difficulty, of course, is that many of the benefits might be, for example, chipping into the Social Security system, which benefits everybody, while the costs for schooling kids are all being imposed on some school district around San Diego. So the benefits and the costs are not matched up well with each other. My own sense, for what it's worth, is that immigration overall is a benefit to the economy, but it's a very small benefit. After all, there's not a big gain to having immigrants if instead what we could do is import things that those folks made while they were in their home countries, which just doesn't change the state of the economy a whole lot. A fourth concern about immigration at the moment is about how it affects wages, and this is different from affecting unemployment. The argument here would be that low-skilled immigrants come in and they compete with low-skilled U.S. workers. Now, that's certainly true to some extent. The problem is with an argument as explaining all the inequality that's happened is when you try and estimate the size of that effect, it's darn small. I mean, we're talking effects that are measured in tenths of a percentage point or something like that, and it's hard to believe that the effects that we see measured in the empirical studies are big enough to cause this fairly large increase in inequality that we've seen. We could, of course, change immigration laws in a number of ways. We could change the family reunification policies. Instead of unifying families, we could focus on accepting immigrants who have certain levels of skills. We could reduce the numbers of immigration, as we did back in the 1920s, at least for a while. We could do both, we could do neither. But I think that immigration is fundamentally one of those subjects which we need to decide more in our hearts than on economic terms. My guess is in economic terms, it's more or less a wash. And what we really need to think about is how we feel about being a country which is welcoming and accepting to immigrants or not. And that's a decision which goes well beyond economic factors. Another kind of insecurity in the labor market in the 1990s is just job insecurity. Sometimes people ask, where will future jobs come from? And it's sort of like they're saying, I don't know if there will be any more jobs. You know, we might not expand the economy at all. I think that's just a silly worry. If the economy had trouble expanding to provide more jobs, we would have run into the problem somewhere during the 20th century. The unemployment rates at the end of the 20th century in a good year are about 5%. At the beginning of the century, in a good year, they were about 5%. You know, we do create jobs. The labor market just comes together and does that by matching up people with things they can do. It just doesn't seem to me a worry. If there was going to be a long-term trend that more population led to a problem with unemployment, we would see some sort of a trend over the last couple of centuries. Of course, the past doesn't prove the future. With the Great Depression in mind, things can always break down. But sort of saying, where are the jobs going to come from is sort of like saying, where are new science and technology going to come from? Where it always came from, just in the way it's been generated over the past century. The insecurity, of course, goes beyond that. It goes beyond the number of jobs to people being laid off, people working part-time, people feeling like they have a lot of short-term jobs and they never got that long-term job with the good fringe benefits. But surprisingly, when you start digging into these numbers, there's actually somewhat less there than meets the eye. For example, if you look at the average number of years a person has been at a job, you see that it really has not changed much from the early 1960s up into the 70s, up into the 80s, and up into the early 1990s. If you look at the percentage of workers who are part-time workers, actually there were more part-time workers in the 1970s than there were in the 1980s or the 1990s as a share of the labor force. If you look at, say, the share of workers who've been with their employer long-term, like more than 10 years, what you tend to see is that that percentage also has really not changed very much over time. Maybe as I give these lectures, there's great insecurity happening out there, and it's all going to show up in the aggregate data over the next 4 or 5 years. But all I can say is that when you go out and look at the studies and the evidence and the data right now, it's hard to find evidence that jobs have really become a lot more insecure. Of course, we've all heard anecdotes, we've all heard stories, but you know, anecdotes don't prove anything. Think about these grand overall number. In about 1980, the economy had 100 million jobs. By 2000, it'll have about 130 million jobs. So for every job lost in the economy over the last two decades, there has to have been a job created to make up for that one that was lost, plus 30 million more. Now, if we had fair and unbiased news coverage of the economy, which reported job gains and job losses on equal weight, we would see an overwhelming number of stories about new job gains. When's the last time you saw a story about lots of new job gains? My guess is that our focus is really on jobs that are lost, and that that's part of a public bias and a media bias that's not reflected in the overall statistics. More broadly, much of what we mean by job insecurity really is about different people being affected by insecurity. There have always been very, very insecure workers in the U.S. economy, and often we called them women and minorities. They were the ones who worked part-time. They were the ones who got laid off. They were the ones who were insecure. When you look at a lot of these insecurity statistics, what you see happening is that women and ethnic minorities are more and more secure in the labor market. They're spending more and more time with employers. There's less and less part-time work. And for white men, what you see is white men are the ones who are spending a little bit less time with their employers, are a little bit more likely to be part-time workers. And so for the labor market as a whole, the amount of insecurity really hasn't changed very much. But who is insecure has been changing. And I think that our perceptions about who is insecure often go back to a certain kind of assumption about who used to work. And that assumption is worth examining before we take it too easily. Another thought that comes out of looking at the statistics closely is that our current idea of job security is often at variance with reality. My sense is that we have a mental idea of a good job. And that job is, it's a job where you work full-time, you're with the person 30 years, you have fringe benefits, you've got pension, you've got health coverage, you've got all this stuff. But you know, if that's the definition of a good job, most people have never had a good job in their lives. Most people don't get that job. Most people, as they go through the labor force, go back and forth between jobs. They spend some time with one employer, some time with another employer. Most people don't end up with a job where they stay with that employer for 30 years and get the corporate gold watch at the end. I think that our mental image of what a secure job is not quite right, because it doesn't take into account that there's always been a lot of different switching between jobs. And we shouldn't take our ideal job and think that that's the standard that everyone has had in the past. That's not a fair way to judge history. So in general, I think it's important for the U.S. to adapt its policies about job security and think more about things where people will be switching between jobs. Think about how we can have pension benefits that are portable across jobs, or health insurance that is portable across jobs, or vacation that is portable across jobs, and think about those kinds of issues more, but to recognize that that's how it's always been and that's how it's going to continue to be in the future. In fact, given that the nature of job insecurity is so hard to get a handle on, I've been coming to believe that when people say they're insecure about their job, what they really mean is that they feel more broadly insecure in an economic sense. And let me give you some of the reasons you could be insecure. You could feel insecure because you're not sure your health insurance coverage is good enough. You could feel insecure because you think Social Security is going to break down and you don't have a pension. You could feel insecure about the lack of future wage growth in the economy, or because you're feeling exposed and vulnerable to foreign competition, or you fear that there's going to be new technology out there which is going to make you obsolete. Or you could just be that as a rich society at the end of the 20th century, we're insecure about taking risks, and we don't want to take the same kind of risks we might have taken before. Now, these are all reasonable fears, and they're all things we might deal with, but they're different fears from saying that jobs are more insecure than they used to be. It's just not clear that jobs are more insecure than they used to be. So, as we think about this kind of broad insecurity and these broad issues that we face for the future, what's the economic agenda that we should be facing as we look toward the 21st century? Now, I'm going to lay out sort of an agenda here, which is an odd mix. Part of it is stuff that I agree with, of course. I'm the lecturer, I get to do that. Part of it also are things where I think there is a broad consensus in the economics community that we should proceed in this way. Of course, when I say broad consensus, that can mean there's some people who strongly disagree. And of course, just because we have a consensus doesn't mean we're actually doing it. But you'll see what I mean as I go along. One item, for example, is I think we need to think about the prudent conduct of monetary policy. And in a lot of ways, I think we now have a fairly strong sense of what that is. The primary goal of monetary policy, there really are two goals. One is just to make sure the economy has enough money in credit to keep growing steadily. The other is to make sure it doesn't get so much money in credit that we end up going into an inflationary cycle. That's a well-understood point at this time. I find it in the mid-1990s just unimaginable that the Federal Reserve will let double-digit inflation get going again. I mean, maybe inflation will go up 1% or 2%. I find it impossible to think that it's going to go up to 10 or 12 or 15%. Similarly, I find it impossible to think that we would go into a Great Depression again because the Federal Reserve would be foolish enough to let the money supply shrink drastically. I just don't think that's going to happen. I think that we have an understanding of the money supply now, which would prevent either of those extremes from going on. So that's one agenda item that we need to pursue into the future, keeping the money supply growing at about the same rate. If our big arguments over time are, should the inflation rate be about 2% or about 5%, that's an argument I can live with. A second agenda item. Think about the benefits of open global trade. I think we've learned something about the benefits of trade. We learned something from the Smoot-Hawley tariffs of the 1930s, and we learned something about the last 50 years of making trade more free under the GATT and now the World Trade Organization. At the turn of the century, about 21% of what the U.S. made in manufacturing goods was exported, and about 44% of the manufacturing goods that we used were imported. Now, we export about 80% of the manufacturing goods made here, and of the manufacturing goods that we use here, about 80% of them are imported. So in the manufacturing sector, we really have become very fully integrated with the rest of the world. In the 1990s, we've twice recommitted our nation to a free trade paradigm. Once by signing the North American Free Trade Agreement to encourage trade between the U.S. and Canada and Mexico, and the second time by leading the global trade talks, where the GATT turned itself into the World Trade Organization. By and large, tariffs, explicit taxes on imports, are really down to pretty much zero now. What we need to take on now in the next century is issues like rules for foreign investment, rules for government subsidies, to discourage that kind of thing, rules to take on subtle kinds of trade barriers or import quotas or other kinds of restrictions that are holding back trade. Now, trade rules are always going to be controversial. There's always going to be significant political support for restricting trade. That's not a surprise. After all, there's always political support for blocking just about anything which involves change. But think about it this way. It's broadly accepted that new technology is a necessary thing. It causes reshaping, it causes difficulty, it causes winners and losers in our economy, but over time, we need to keep embracing it. You can also say the same for markets, that, you know, markets cause enormous reshuffling. They cause winners and losers. They cause pain and angst and upset. But over time, you need to keep embracing markets in order to get long-term growth. You can say the same thing about foreign trade. Sure, it causes turmoil, it causes upset, it causes winners and losers. But over time, embracing trade is clearly a way which encourages and takes advantage of economic progress. The lesson of this century in the United States is fairly clear. The economy has grown best when we were opening up most to trade, as during the 1950s and 1960s. It's grown least when we were closing down to trade, as in the 1930s. Now, trade is not the only thing that matters. I'm not making that claim. I'm just saying that it's fairly clear that trade is beneficial to the overall economy, even though it's sometimes painful. The international experience is also clear here. Think of Germany and Japan rebuilding after World War II, or the East Asian countries expanding in recent years. Countries that embrace trade do pretty well. And then think about the experience of the Soviet Union or Latin America in the post-war years. Clearly, those are nations which did not embrace trade and tried to manage it in various ways, and they didn't do so well. A third big thing that I think needs to be an agenda item for the 21st century is, in general, the importance of reducing the budget deficit. Now, of course, this is something we all want to do, but we don't know how to do. But let me try and give you a sense of the payoff if we can get it under control. A study by the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office in 1996 said that if we continue on our present budget path, the real GDP per person will be about the same in the year 2030 as it is in the year 2005. There will literally be no per capita GDP growth over that time because of the way the budget deficits will blossom and eat up all the investment capital. However, their simulation said that if we permanently balance the budget, then per capita GDP would instead grow by about 1% a year over those 25 years. So it would be 25% higher by the year 2030. That would be because the federal government was not soaking up the funds for private investment and not driving the U.S. into becoming ever more of a foreign debtor. As a nation, we need to save more and invest more. Our single biggest borrower is the federal government. It's time to try and get the federal government to be saving more so the rest of us can invest more. A fourth theme for the 1990s and for the 21st century is to take advantage of the power of markets. And you can think of this happening in a variety of different areas. I think what we learned during the 1980s, really, and maybe during the 70s as well, is that this idea of wage and price controls and regulating everything in sight, which was so popular through the middle of the century, is really just not a useful way to go. And it's better to think about letting market forces kind of rip free and then regulating the particular things that we need need to regulate, rather than some sort of a blanket approach. And in the 1990s, you can see this attitude becoming widespread across a variety of industries. For example, let's talk about farming in the 1990s. The number of farms, of course, has been shrinking, but the size of those farms has been increasing. In 1945, the country had 6 million farms with an average size of about 200 acres. Now, there are about 2 million farms with an average size of 500 acres. But less than 2% of the nation's workforce is on the farm. The largest 400,000 farms account for 75% of all farm sales. So the real farming sector is those big 500,000 farms. Rural areas have been developing more and more service and manufacturing jobs, and they're not so dependent on farm income anymore. Of the nation's 2,300 non-metropolitan counties, only 25% get more than one-fifth of their income from agriculture. So more and more rural areas are relying not on agriculture, but on services, manufacturing, tourism. There's a farm bill passed in 1995. It starts the gradual process of getting the government out of the farming industry, of phasing down these farm payments that have been going on since the 1930s. In fact, although it's not widely known, two-thirds of farming doesn't get any federal support now. And one of the interesting facts is that that two-thirds that doesn't get any federal support seems to be doing just as well as the one-third that does. So what we really should be doing in some ways is to equalize things across the farming sector. There's also deregulation in telecommunications. In 1996, we deregulated the telecommunications industry to allow the baby bells, the spin-offs from AT&T, as well as long-distance companies and cable TV and computer firms, and just about anybody else to start providing communications and phone service, both on the long distance and the local level. Now, my guess is this is kind of be like airline deregulation. There'll be a whole bunch of people who rush in, then there'll be a whole lot of mergers, there'll be a whole bunch of people who rush out. We'll need to keep playing with the rules in various ways to assure there's competition. But allowing this initial surge to happen seems to me the right thing. In terms of markets, we need to think about healthcare markets. The basic concerns in this area are well known. The U.S. spends far more per person on healthcare than any other country. In the mid-1990s, the U.S. is spending more than twice as much per person on healthcare as Australia, Italy, Japan, Sweden, and the United Kingdom. We're spending 50% more per person than Canada, France, Germany, or Switzerland, or basically any other country in the world. We need to think about how we can structure our healthcare system to make sure that we cover those people who don't currently have access to care. Now, there have been a lot of ways of thinking about this, a lot of ways of thinking about how could we make sure that better care got provided. To me, a lot of them come down to one study that was done at the Rand Corporation in the 1970s. They compared two groups of patients. One group of patients that had access to health care with no out-of-pocket cost, and another group that had to pay a co-payment that was about a third of the cost. At the end of several years, they followed up on this group, and what they found out was that the group that had to pay the co-payments used one-third less care, which you might expect because they had to pay the money out of pocket. But that group also had exactly the same health status as the group that had gotten the care free of charge. Now, that kind of study, and there have been many studies like this done, have allowed many people to propose estimates that maybe about as much as one-third of the $1 trillion or so that we're spending on healthcare every year may literally have no health benefit at all. It may just be care that we're providing because it's cheap and easy to get it, and there's no cost consciousness in the system. We need to think about ways where we can make people more cost-conscious, both doctors and patients. Clinton's proposed healthcare plan in 1993 and 94 foundered largely because it had too much government control and not enough role for market forces. I'm not quite sure what the answer is for healthcare, but I know that we need to create a situation where patients bear some, not all, but some of the financial cost when they go in to get care. And doctors and medical providers bear some of the risk when they decide to provide care as well. Finding that kind of a balance of how much of the risk should each side provide and letting the market play a role after that point is going to be the real challenge in healthcare reform. A final area of market-oriented reform is banking regulation. You may remember that an awful lot of bank regulations were set up in the 1930s in the aftermath of the Great Depression, like the deposit insurance for banks that led to the government being forced into the savings and loan bailout, or the Glass-Steagall banking law of 1933 that stopped banks from going into insurance and stockbroking and other kinds of financial industries. My sense is that in many, many circles, it's now widely accepted that those laws restricting and banking really serve no function. What they really do is they make banks weak and more likely to fail. And that we've got to give banks more power to expand out and compete in different areas, just like the banks in Japan and Germany are currently allowed to do. Now, of course, that will involve new kinds of regulation. I'm not saying we should not have any regulation of the banking system, but I think it's time, after 60 years after the Great Depression, to start allowing that greater freedom. A fifth big agenda item for the 21st century is we need to plan for the aging of the baby boom. I've mentioned a number of times, I think, that Social Security and Medicare are headed for a severe financial crunch when the baby boomers get old, about 2020 or 2030. In fact, Medicare is going to need to be rescued before then. It's facing a short-term crunch as well. The problem, broadly, is the boomers are all going to age at once and longer life expectancies. When Social Security was created back in the 1930s, there were about 6 workers to pay taxes to support every retiree. By 1980, there were only 3 workers to support each retiree, and we're headed for a ratio of about 2-1 early in the next century. Also, men are retiring earlier and earlier. You may remember that back in 1900, about 66% of the men over 65 were in the workforce. But that goes down and down and down over time. By 1970, only 27% of the men over age 65 are in the workforce. In 1980, it's less than 20%. And that ratio of men working to longer and longer ages is falling and falling and falling and falling. Now, at one level, earlier retirement is definitely a good thing. But, you know, we may not be able to afford giving everyone in this country retirement at age 60. I mean, think about it. It used to be that you started working at age 15 and you worked till you died. Now we have a situation where people don't start working maybe until about age 25 when they're out of school, and they want to retire at age 60 and then live another 30 years after that. It's just not clear how that system can work in the long run. Now, we can go a fair business to save Social Security and Medicare with tinkering. You know, we can push back the retirement age a little more. We could tax benefits a little bit. We could require higher co-payments for Medicare, raise the taxes a little bit, all those kinds of things. If I had to guess what's going to happen, that's what we're going to do. We're going to tinker and we're going to muddle on through. But let me push the envelope a little bit on what else we might be thinking about. We should probably rethink the role of the elderly in the workforce. Lots of elderly folks have useful skills, and we need to think about how we can draw on them as a society. For example, for teachers in schools, for supervising after-school activities, maybe for daycare or home care of some sort, as clerks or assistants in jobs like real estate or insurance or tax preparation. I think what's really going to be hard is that we used to sort of have a rule which was after age 65, you were out of the labor force and you were done. And we kind of had that as a clear rule. But it's going to be a lot harder if people stay in the labor force over time. We're going to have to be able to confront an older person and say, look, you know, your hearing or your vision or your abilities have deteriorated in some way, and you have to get a different job. Society's going to have to come up with ways of doing that, and workers are going to have to come up, and older Americans, with ways of hearing that. And there's a kind of necessary realism in all of that, which I'm just not sure how it's all going to work out. Another thing we could do is we really need to rethink what we expect of people in planning for old age. There are way too many people who seem to think, look, all my retirement income is Social Security, Medicare is paid for, I own my house, I've got my corporate pension, so I don't need to plan for the future. It's important that we get people to plan more for their own future. And in fact, making a bold prediction, I think we're headed toward a system where we are going to require people to set aside certain amounts of savings in a private account with their name on it. We may do that as part of a Social Security reform or part of a Medicare reform, but I think we're going to start saying to folks, we're going to require you to save up money for your own future. We can't just leave that to you anymore. Yet another agenda item for the 21st century is to try and get the most out of the workforce from all the different participants. And that includes people who haven't traditionally had an equal shot at the workforce, like women, African Americans, and other minorities, and also our latest problem, low-skilled men. Women are really entering the labor force in extraordinarily active ways toward the end of the century. And young women, especially young unmarried women, are essentially at parity with men in terms of the wages they're getting. Women are also starting an extraordinary number of small new businesses. The number of women-owned businesses doubled from the late 1980s to the mid-1990s, up to 8 million. Many of these are small, but the 8 million women-owned firms do employ 18.5 million people. So, you know, about 2 employees per business. On the other hand, while women own many small companies, they have not risen to the top in big companies. A federal commission found in 1995 that only about 5% of senior executive positions are held by women in corporate America. However, it was true that the senior corporate women had an average age of 44, and the senior corporate men had an average age of 56. So maybe as women grow older, it will just sort of be a matter of time. That'll be something to keep an eye on. In terms of African Americans, it would certainly be true to say that on balance, the fight against racial discrimination in the labor force is a success story. Things have gotten better over time. By the end of the century, however, we haven't yet reached equality. However, for blacks of the same education level, and for black women and white women, we're darn close to certain levels of wage equality. However, there's still deep concerns. There's some mild evidence that regression is happening, that in the 1970s, a college-educated man was earning about the same as a college-educated white man, but that we've slipped back a little bit over time. I guess the real issue here is that the form of discrimination has changed. It's no longer straightforward racial discrimination in the same way, but it is that black students as a whole aren't getting the same level of education as white students and aren't hooked up to the labor market in the same way. And trying to fix that is a real hard issue. The remaining problem is how we can get people, especially low-skilled males, into the labor market. And frankly, I don't know how to do this. I think part of the wisdom, though, is for us to be more realistic and not say, look, everyone's going to be a college graduate, everyone's going to be a lawyer, everyone's going to be a doctor, and think about how we can get people into jobs like being a home health care worker, or installing computer and video systems, or yard and garden work, or other jobs that require definite skills and you can get serious pay for, but that are not assuming that every person is going to grow up and get an advanced degree. A final step is to tend to the roots of growth. The roots of growth, as we've talked about over and over, are things like science and technology, investing in education and human capital, and investing in physical capital. And we've talked about these throughout the lectures. In terms of physical capital, we need to stop the government from borrowing so much money so there's more capital available for private industry. And we need to keep inflation low and have a stable economic environment so businesses can focus in planning for the future. We need to have more research and development spending. Research and development spending for the country as a whole actually goes flat. It pretty much levels off in the late 1980s. And it has not been revived by either President Bush or President Clinton or by private industry. We can't go into the future with research and development spending not increasing. We need to spend more money on grants to universities, more money on grants to industrial consortia. I think we need to have tax credits for industry to make sure they spend more on research and development too. And finally, in terms of education, I think it's probably time that our country thinks seriously about how we're going to get another surge of education to really raise the educational level in this country. As we did in the 1920s with a surge of people going to high school, as we did in the 1950s with a surge of people going to college. Even at the end of the century, as I mentioned before, only about half of all U.S. students go on to any higher education beyond high school. And of those, only about 25% of students will complete a four-year college degree. There are two different roads we could go in increasing education. One would be to dramatically expand higher education and college education, and that's one possible way to go. My own preference, however, is that I really think we should focus expanding education on K through 12, and particularly perhaps on K through 6, because there's a lot of evidence out there that when you get to kids early, if you can get good learning habits early, that that has a great effect all the way through their career. And expanding college education for people who haven't had a particularly good K through 12 education just doesn't seem to me like a useful way to go. Either way, though, if we're going to expand those educational opportunities a lot, we're going to have to spend more money. It's going to be more for teachers, more for longer school years, more for resources. We may have to reorganize the system in various kind of dramatic ways. Now, there's, of course, a whole argument here about school vouchers and other things that I don't want to get into in this lecture, but I think that somehow making a determination that we will really try to dramatically expand the education of young kids in this country is an important priority. priority for our future. Of course, these three go together. New technology helps lead to new investment. Greater education helps lead to new technology. More skilled workers can work with better machines. These three seeds of growth all come together. The 1990s have been a decade without nasty events, like the oil price shocks of the 1970s, or a giant world war, or a depression, or anything like that. We haven't had any big new social programs, we haven't had any big monopolies, and at least as these lectures are being given, we haven't done anything sweeping like the healthcare reform President Clinton proposed. But major issues are lurking just under the surface. The budget deficit, Social Security, reform of healthcare, welfare dependency, education, science and technology, and a lot more. I do worry that for these kinds of long-term issues, we aren't showing a lot of capability in our public life to come to grips with them. We're waiting for disasters to happen rather than planning ahead. History teaches us that those who are leading are always somewhat vulnerable. Think of Great Britain, for example, which was very near the top of the world in 1900, but by the 1990s was below the average for Europe as a whole in its standard of living. The forces of growth and problems like these are slow but inexorable. The time to start coming to grips with our long-term problems is not 2050, not 2030, not 2010, or even 22. We need a little more urgency. The time to start acting on these problems is right now.
I'm Tom Rollins, president of the Teaching Company. We hope you've enjoyed the lectures on these tapes. To order more courses or to receive a copy of our most recent catalog, call 1-800-TEACH-12. That's 1-800-TEACH-12. Or visit us on the internet at www.teachco.com. That's teachco.com. Thank you very much for listening.